Dying Grace, an exposition of Genesis chapter 47, verses 28 through 31. This message by Pastor Rod Harris was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church on Wednesday evening, February the 23rd, 2011.
Well, it's something that we're all going to have to face sooner or later. And most of us would just as soon it be later than sooner. But should the Lord tarry, we all are going to die. Death is inevitable. I checked on the statistics today. 1 in 1 still die. Providing the Lord doesn't return, that's where all of us are heading. It is inevitable. And it's not necessarily a popular subject, but it is an essential subject. It's the kind of thing that we have to deal with as the people of God. Understanding that as God's people, our perspective related to death ought to be different from the perspective of the folks around us. When we look at death, when we deal with death, when we talk about death, the way we look at it, the way we deal with it, the way we respond to it, how we even speak of it, should be radically different from those who do not know Christ. We face it with a spirit, an attitude that is to be very different. The biblical mandate is not only that we should live for Jesus or live the truth of our faith, but we should die in faith. Past generations used to speak of dying grace, grace that was given to those at the last in order to exhibit their faith and their confidence in Christ and in the world to come. We have a powerful picture of dying grace in Genesis chapter 47, beginning at verse 28. And that's going to be our text tonight. Genesis 47, 28 through 31. Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the days of Jacob, the years of his life, were 147 years. And when the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, "If now I have found favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh and promise to deal kindly and truly with me. Do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. Carry me out of Egypt and bury me in the burying place." He answered, "I will do as you have said." And he said, "Swear to me." And he swore to him. Then Israel bowed himself upon his bed and worshiped. Dying grace. Grace to face the final days. Grace to face death with dignity, strength, and passion. Here we have the beginning of the scriptural account of the death of Jacob, the great patriarch. Who would have thought that the old supplanter, the old schemer, would provide us such an example of dying faith? The Bible rarely deals with deathbed scenes, but when we come to deal with Jacob, there are several deathbed scenes. The death of Abraham is described in just a couple of verses. He, as the father of the Jews, Father Abraham, his death is described in this way. "Then Abraham breathed his last and died at a good old age, an old man full of years, and he was gathered to his people." One verse, a simple statement. It's a profound statement. It's a great statement, but it doesn't go on and on. The death of Isaac and Joseph are told in even fewer words than Abraham. In the New Testament, the death of most of the chief characters, including Paul, are not even recorded. So that's why it's strange to me about the death of Jacob. Because the account of his death begins here at the end of chapter 47, and he doesn't die until the end of chapter 49. You know, what it reminds me of is that he's an actor and he's got this death scene and he won't get it over with. He just keeps dragging it on. He just keeps dragging it out. He's milking this scene for everything he can get. In chapter 50, then, we're given the account of his burial. The story includes three different deathbed scenes. One in 47, the one we just looked at, another in 48, and another in chapter 49. Now, we're all aware of Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 27. Man is appointed once to die and then to face the judgment. How are we to face it? How are we to deal with death? Death is inevitable, so it's something we must consider. He's lived for 17 years in Egypt. And in many respects, those 17 years were the best years. Because you remember how long he lived thinking his son was dead. You remember the heartache that he went through all of those years. Then he has 17 really good years. The family's together. His son is in a place of prominence. It was a good time. And now death is coming. There was a time when he felt like dying earlier. Do you remember that? It's back in Genesis 37. I'm sure he thought about dying when he was going to face Esau after 20 years in Paddan Aram. You remember, he sent everybody else ahead and he stayed on the other side of the river to kind of prepare himself and to get himself ready. Maybe if I send these on ahead of me, maybe if I give him gifts, I can soften it a little bit. I'm sure he thought he was going to die, because I would imagine that as he's going back, he pictured his brother's face, "I'm going to kill you." And he knew his brother meant it. Now he's going to face him. So there have been times in his life he felt like he was going to die. There were times when he wanted to die. Now he is facing death itself. The interesting thing is he's not banishing the thoughts of death. He's not pushing it away. He's not saying, "I don't want to face this. I don't want to deal with it." He is rather embracing it. He embraced it as a believer in God and prepared to testify to his faith to the very end. When the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and he said to him, "If now I have found favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh and promise to deal kindly and truly with me. Do not bury me in Egypt." Jacob becomes an example for us of how to face death with dignity, grace, and faith. Three things I want to point out to you about dying grace. First, dying grace trusts in the faithfulness of God's promise to the very end. Dying grace is that grace that God gives to us as His people that testifies, that trusts in, that believes in, that counts on God's faithfulness to the very end. That God is true to His Word, that God will do what He said He would do. That when God promises His presence, when God promises He will never leave or forsake, that we hold on to that we hold it dear, and that we treasure it and cling to it and hold on to it regardless of what's going on, regardless of what is surrounding us. If we're not careful, we'll miss important lessons in this passage, because it's, again, a kind of summary passage, the kind that we read quickly and move on to something exciting. We want to get past this and get on to the good stuff, and in doing so, we miss something very important. I want you to look at what Jacob is saying. Jacob's not just seeking to avoid being buried in Egypt. This is not just an old man's dying wish to be buried on the old home place. That's not what's happening here. Jacob's request was tied to the promise of God, the promise made to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob. God had promised some great things to them, to all of them. He made the promise to Abraham, but he made it again to Isaac and then to Jacob. He promised to make them a great nation. He promised descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. He promised a Messiah who would come and do great work in that land, the land that he was given to them. The promises were always tied to the land. Again and again and again, the promise was tied to the land that was promised. So when Jacob desires to be taken back to the land and buried, he's doing so because God had made some promises and the land was precious. He wasn't just saying, "You know, take me home to the farm and put me out in the family cemetery." He was clinging to the promise of God and God's faithfulness. He wanted his body to be in the land where God would again one day bring this people, where the Messiah would eventually be born and perform the work of redemption. This is one of the things that should set us apart from the world. We have a different view of the world and history. We look at everything radically different from the people around us. We see world events and we interpret them differently. We see things happening in our own family and we see it differently, so that we react in a way that a non-believer cannot react. We ought to be different. our faith, our trust in Christ, our belief in the Scripture ought to make us strange and peculiar to those people who don't have our hope. The Bible calls us a peculiar people. That means different, distinct. The problem is we're not that different from the folks around us. We tend to react the same way they do. Death for the people of God is a very different thing than death for those who have no hope. And we see an example of that in the life of Jacob. There are different ways to look at history. Some view history as just inevitable progress. There are those that say, you know, history is just moving on. This comes from the evolutionary view of the world. It's steeped in Darwinism and the evolutionary theory that the world just keeps getting better and better, that we are far superior and advanced in every way beyond those who came before us. That was a very popular view in the middle to late 19th century, early 20th century, but World War I, World War II, and a lot of things since then has kind of dampened the enthusiasm for that view of history. That we're just getting better and better and better. Some are saying, well, it looks like the opposite direction to me. It looks like we're getting worse and worse and worse. But one way of looking at the world, one way of viewing it, the naturalistic interpretation of the world is that we're just obviously getting better. We know more. There is more education. There's more experience. And so it must be better. Others look at the world and see it as the ancient Greeks did, that it's just a hopeless, endless cycle. It's the same old thing over and over again. We have ups and downs, but we're really getting nowhere. We're really coming back to the same spot. We're going through the same things everybody's always gone through because it's just a meaningless ritual. It's just a meaningless drudgery. And we just all go around this circle the same as all the generations before us. It's just spinning. Round and round it goes, and where it stops, nobody really knows and nobody really cares. That's one way of looking at the world. And I'd suggest to you the way you look at the world has a direct bearing on how you look at death. If you have a hopeless view of history, if history doesn't really mean anything, if it's all without purpose, then who cares? That's not the way we as the people of God. History is going somewhere. History is moving in a specific direction. History is marching according to the beat of God's drum. Jacob didn't see it as an evolving progress. He didn't see it as a meaningless cycle. He saw the world as having been created by God, a God who interacted with his people and made promises to them. And thus he has hope. The meaning of life is not found merely in what happened to us in one particular moment or even all the moments combined, but rather the total flow of history of which each of us is a part. In other words, our worth is not found in what we accomplish or even what we as a race do through technology. Our worth is in our being made by God in His image and likeness and being placed by Him within the framework of what He's doing in history. Our worth, our value, is because we're His. He's the one that gives us meaning and purpose and value, and that we're part of what God is doing in the world. And if I view all of life from that perspective, then I have a very different understanding of death. Because it's not random. It's not without meaning. Now, if I believe that God is moving all things according to His plan, if I hold to the doctrine of the sovereignty of God, and I believe that nothing happens by chance, but everything happens according to the eternal decree of God, does that mean I understand what's going on? No. Does it mean I like what's going on? No. But it does mean I have hope. It does mean that I have perspective and I can look beyond my ability. I can look beyond my understanding and trust in what God is saying. Jacob is dying in faith. In fact, Hebrews 11 and verse 13 speaks of all these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. Jacob was clinging to the promise of God. This whole thing about don't bury me here in Egypt, but take me back to the land, was his clinging to the promise of God. It's tied to the land. It's symbolic. He wants to be gathered with his people. He wants to be gathered with his family. Second, dying grace holds the promise of God to the very end. Second, dying grace is confident of life to come. He's confident that there's more to it, that this is not the end of the story. The thing that separates us, the thing that marks us off as distinctly different as the people of God, is that when you and I stand on that little rug of artificial grass and look over that box, we don't turn around and walk away and say, that's the end. We say, they're not even there. Because life didn't end. We have confidence, we have hope that there is more life to come. We have confidence, we have hope that to be absent from this body is to be present with the Lord. Look carefully at verses 29 and 30. When the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, I know I found favor in your sight. If now I have favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh and promise to deal kindly with me. Do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. Carry me out of Egypt and bury me in the burying place. He speaks of when I rest with my fathers. Carry me out of Egypt and bury me where they are buried. Jacob is confessing his confidence in a life to come. Abraham was gathered with his people. Isaac was gathered with his people. And Jacob wanted to be gathered with his people. Psalm 49, beginning at verse 10. For he sees that even the wise die, the fool and the stupid alike must perish and leave their wealth to others. Their graves are their homes forever, their dwelling places to all generations, though they called lands by their own names. Man in his pomp will not remain. He is like the beasts that perish. This is the path of those who have foolish confidence. Yet after them people approve of their boast. Like sheep they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. Their form shall be consumed in Sheol, with no place to dwell. But God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, and he will receive me. They're destined to the grave. I'm not. They who do not believe have no hope. But I have hope. That's what the psalmist is saying. That's what Jacob is affirming in our text. Psalm 73, nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand, you guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will receive me in glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Confidence, hope, assurance that there is life yet to come. Did Jacob have a full, detailed understanding of the resurrection and life after death? I don't think so. I don't think he had any clear understanding of that. But he did understand that God was the God of the living. He was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Though both Abraham and Isaac had died, they're still spoken of in the present tense. Now, if Jacob, an Old Testament patriarch, could face death with such confidence, shouldn't we face it with far more? As New Testament saints, as those who have the completed canon, as those who have the Gospels, as those who have the story of the resurrection of Christ, as those who have the testimony of the witness of the Spirit for the last 20 centuries, shouldn't we face death with greater confidence than Jacob? The answer is obvious. Dying grace clings to the promise of God to the very end, dying grace is confident that there is life yet to come, and dying grace greets death with celebration. Now, it can be missed in the English translation because we're told that Israel bowed himself upon the head of his bed. But the word that's translated bowed is a word for worship. As he faced death, he worshiped. He gave praise and glory and honor to God. Jacob praised God as he was dying. It's interesting to note that that's what Jacob's remembered for in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 21. In the great hall of faith, in Hebrews 11, by faith Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. Now, what do we know about Jacob? Well, it wasn't a great beginning. He didn't have a great childhood. I mean, he was a deceiver. He was a lying, whining mama's boy. He cheated and stole his brother's blessing. He tried to cheat his father-in-law and then got some of his own medicine in return. But what is he remembered for? What does the New Testament say of him? In the face of death, he worshiped God. That's grace. That's not natural to Jacob. Jacob, left to himself, would not face death in this way. But Jacob, empowered by the grace and presence of God, faced death with confidence, strength, dignity, and grace. Testimony to the grace and provision of God is valuable at any period of life and in any circumstance, but it's especially meaningful at the end of life as death begins to cast its shadow. May God grant dying grace that we might, even in our dying, give evidence of the testimony of the grace and the provision of our God. My hope is that I would end well. My hope is that when that time comes, my life may speak the praise and glory of my God. And we don't know when that's going to happen. I mean, we may say, well, you know, I'm young enough, I should have X number of years ahead of me. Or you may say, I was at the doctor and he said I'm healthy and I've got another however many years. None of us have any assurance. We may not get through tonight. So we pray that God would grant us grace. I found out last Wednesday after I got home that Alan Day, pastor of First Baptist Church Edmond, last Wednesday evening, got on his motorcycle at church and was going home to get his wife to bring her back for the fellowship meal, and he died in a motorcycle accident. Had no idea. He was running home to get his wife so they could get back to church and eat a meal and then fellowship with the folks and go to prayer meeting. Instead, as the folks were sitting around the tables eating their meal, a staff member had to stand up and say, "Our pastor's gone. He's in the presence of the Lord," and called everyone into the auditorium for a time of prayer. And they had his funeral yesterday and buried him today in Arkansas. You don't know. So you pray that by the grace of God, by his kindness and goodness, that you might be strong and your life testify to the grace of God. Now, I'm grateful that through the last almost 20 years now, that I've had the honor and the privilege of being at the death side of many of our folks. And I've watched them die in grace. I've watched them strong to the end. I've watched them laugh and face death with courage. Not because they were particularly strong, not because they just had a strong constitution or were stubborn and just they're going to do it, but God gave His grace. That's my hope. I don't have any hope that I can get there on my own. I know otherwise. I know my weakness. I know my failings. I know my fears. My only hope is that God is faithful to His Word and He'll grant grace. We are to be a peculiar people. A different people. And one place where that difference needs to shine is in the way we face the final moments. So how do we get there? I think we begin now and pray and seek the grace of God and pray that God would grant us that specifically. We don't wait to, well, gee, doctor told me today I've got a week, so I'm going to really start on this now. No, start now. And hopefully you pray that for a long, long time. But you pray trusting, believing that God is faithful to His Word. May God grant us dying grace so that we not only live the faith, but we die in the faith.
You've been listening to a Plowman podcast. Find us on the web at theplowman.org. The Plowman features the preaching ministry of Rod Harris, pastor of Trinity Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, located at the corner of 41st and Union. To learn more about the ministries at Trinity Baptist Church, visit us on the web at www.tbctulsa.org.